We're talking about synthetic chemicals called PFAS here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin DNR did three rounds of sampling this summer at sites that were near likely sources of PFAS, and that they found, in the initial testing at least, that elevated levels are occurring in rivers and creeks. Starkweather Creek in Madison had the highest concentration. So what questions do you have about PFAS? How would you like the state and local government to manage chemical contamination in our river bodies? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Zellmer is a water quality manager with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
So tell us what the DNR sampling learned here about what we're seeing in contamination in these waterways.
Yeah, so this is really our initial attempts at trying to assess and monitor our surface waters for PFAS contamination. As you had mentioned, we had sampled, it turns out to be eventually seven sites around the state. We had started with five, but we added two more sites to get an idea of the current concentrations of PFAS in our surface waters. As you had mentioned, Starkweather Creek here in Madison had exhibited the highest levels of PFAS to a point where we will now start looking at that more closely, evaluating that, determine what additional sampling needs to be done, and then also working with the Dane County, Truax Field, and the City of Madison to help us investigate this.
Well, step back for us and explain to us what are PFAS and why are we worried about this?
Sure. So PFAS is a group of essentially thousands of compounds that are used in a variety of products, everything from our some of our firefighting foams that our fire departments use, in some of our specialty papers, some of our coated papers, as a suppressant in some of our chrome plating fabricating facilities and other uses. So a very wide use of these compounds. They've been used for decades. More recently, some of the health effects related to this have become more apparent, and that's really what has brought us up to today, where we're looking at what other, primarily in other states, at manufacturing facilities that have had some health-related problems around those. We've looked at that, and we're taking in a closer look now in Wisconsin on those issues.
What are the health concerns here? What should we be worried about?
Yeah, so the health concerns are primarily with developmental issues. So really the most sensitive population, according to our Department of Health Services, is this would be for the fetus, you know, in a pregnant mom, as well as young infants, and the exposure to that. Some long-term effects could include some developmental issues, some hormonal issues, issues related to cholesterol, and also the possibility of cancer from long-term exposure to these compounds.
We're talking with Jim Zellmer. He's a water quality specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about PFAS, these synthetic chemicals used in a variety of nonstick products, as Jim has been saying, firefighting foam, and the compounds are showing up in our waterways. Your questions here on the DNR results, 800-642-1234. Let's go to John in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
My question for the DNR person is, you speculated that this chemical could cause cancer and could cause developmental defects, and I would like to know what detailed studies you can quote that say that, because I think there's a lot of misinformation going on out there that, you know, if you have too much salt, it can kill you. It's all manner of, and
yeah,
whether there's factual evidence that the low levels that are parts per trillion are some.
Yeah, John, and you're breaking up there a bit. And John, you know, wondering, how do you determine what the appropriate level of contamination is? What indicators show that it is at a dangerous level, Jim?
Yes, thank you very much. Very good question, John Rhinelander. And we rely heavily on our Department of Health Services, on our State Department of Health Services. We recently had sent them a request for their recommendations on setting standards for two of the PFAS, PFOA and PFOS. They have sent us their recommendations, and those are based on review of really essentially thousands of research documents on this. It would be best to visit the Department of Health Services website. If you just simply type in, go to DHS's website and type in PFAS, and you'll come up with a fact sheet, and you can look at what studies they use to provide that recommendation. And there are some very good studies. Again, primarily there's what's called the C8 study that was done in West Virginia, and some of the other areas around some of the manufacturing facilities, 3M and DuPont, in the United States that had significant, the workers and nearby residents had significant health effects from that. And so those are some of the studies that were used to establish this criteria.
So Jim, tell us where we are in the study phase here. We've got the water samples. There were three rounds of sampling. You've got some initial results back. What happens next?
Right. So as you had mentioned, so we did three rounds this summer at these various locations. We collected samples in June, July, and August. Those samples were sent to our State Laboratory of Hygiene. We have the first round back. They indicated elevated levels primarily on Starkweather Creek here in Madison. So our next step is working. We do have a known source of contamination up at the north end of Starkweather Creek, that being the Dane County Regional Airport and Truax Field. So now the next step will be working with that entity, as well as the city of Madison, to evaluate and to do additional sampling along Starkweather Creek to really establish, try to identify what the source of this contamination is and then address that source. I should also mention we did do paired sampling at these locations. We also collected fish specimens. Those samples were expecting later this year. Those take some time because of the processing required to process and analyze the fish specimens. But that information then will be used by our Department of Health and us to take a look at our current fish consumption advisories and determine if the current statewide consumption advisory is adequate or if they need to be adjusted based on the contamination.
Jim, what is the remedy here to PFAS contamination? Is there a remedy? What do we do?
Yeah, so with that, you know, first we try to identify the source and remove that source. So essentially, like in, you know, you can imagine in the health world, really to stop the bleeding. So what we want to do is eliminate that source and prevent that. The next step is then to remediate the area. So then that may be treating the water. There are a few options for treating the water using some of either granular activated carbon or anion exchange to treat the water to get it down to an acceptable level. So that's what we'll be working with, like I had mentioned, for our known sources, the parties that are known to be responsible for that, but also as we identify other areas, we'll try to identify the source, remove that source, and then work on a remedial action plan.
Well, Jim, thanks for bringing us up to speed. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Jim Zellmer is Deputy Division Administrator of Environmental Management for the DNR. We've been talking about high levels of hazardous chemicals known as PFAS showing up in Wisconsin rivers and creeks. Coming up, our state is facing a workforce housing shortage. We'll talk about it. Look at the real estate issues around the state. Hear your situation on housing in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about our state's housing challenges here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New study by the Wisconsin Realtors Association says Wisconsin is on the cusp of not being able to adequately provide housing for a growing workforce. Housing starts, they're not keeping up. Construction costs are outpacing inflation. And then there's outdated zoning. That's an issue. So we're going to work through all of this, all of it, with your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you trying to buy your first home? What's your challenge? Did you recently buy or sell a home? What was that process like? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Kurt Paulson is an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture here at UW-Madison. He's the author of this study called Falling Behind, Addressing Wisconsin's Workforce Housing Shortage. Kurt, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to the Great Recession, 2008, and bring us forward where we see these current housing struggles. What did you see from the Great Recession? Where were we at with housing?
So actually, I'll take you back before the Great Recession. So Wisconsin used to build about 36,000 housing units every year, more or less, which was a normal market. Obviously, production went up a little bit right before the Great Recession. But during the Great Recession, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country, housing production went way down, close to zero. But of course, people are still forming families and jobs are being created. And so in other states, housing production has come back online. But in Wisconsin, it really hasn't. Now we build about 18,000 units a year. So that's about half of what we used to produce. But as you know, in small towns, in our growing urban and suburban job centers, we're adding jobs, we're adding people, but we're not adding enough housing units to keep up with population or income. And so we call this report Falling Behind because from a state perspective, if you're adding people and adding jobs, but you're not adding housing, then there's a real shortage of supply at all price points.
And that's where you call it workforce housing.
Right. It particularly impacts those on the lower end of the wage scale, right? Because if a person is upper middle income, they're going to be able to find a place to live either in the community they want to live in or close to their jobs. But for those who are making maybe even $10, $15, $20 an hour, that housing is in short supply, and so oftentimes they may have to either live far away from work and drive long distances, or they may have to pay 50% of their income just to afford the rent or the housing.
So what's going on? Why haven't housing starts bounced back?
So in the report, we talk about three reasons. We see housing production shortfalls across the country, and so other states are dealing with this as well. But in Wisconsin, we got particularly hard hit by the recession, and a number of contractors and labor left the construction and building trades. And so we talk about in the report that most contractors in Wisconsin, and anyone who's tried to do housing rehab knows this, it's just impossible to find contractors and labor. And all the developers we talk to in the northern part of the state, in the southeast, there's just a real shortage of labor, right? Construction costs have also gone up, and that's partially due to factors outside of our control. So softwood lumber is up almost 26% to 30% year over year.
Oh, so that house to build it for that developer, it's going to cost a lot more.
Right.
And they won't see, then they're going to have to ask so much more for the purchase price.
Right.
And they may not see quite that payoff
right.
to build
In fact,
that
that's,
house.
That's one of the big issues is people say, well, if we have such a shortage of housing, then why aren't developers able to respond and build the house that people want? But the issue, as you pointed out, is if land costs are high, and construction costs are high, then even a developer building a small house that maybe used to be a starter home, that house might be in outside of our urban areas might be $280,000 to buy in Wisconsin. And in here in Dane County, for example, a small house on a small lot will start at $400,000. And the income that people need to be able to afford that is just not keeping up. So we have this strange situation where we need more housing built, but any new construction is going to have to be – a developer is going to have to get the rent to cover her debt service or the house price to cover the cost of her land and the improvements.
We're talking with Kurt Paulson. He's an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. He recently wrote the study called Falling Behind. It's addressing the state's workforce housing shortage. Did you recently buy or sell a home? Was it a struggle? Were there a lot of people interested? Did the home go for more than it's worth or less? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kurt, what is the condition of our existing housing stock? Now, I know that's a very broad question because it can vary so dramatically from place to place. But what are you seeing out there?
So one of the things we talk about in the report is Wisconsin's housing stock is aging faster than other states. So if you look at the kind of middle of the housing age, that will tell you how much you're adding new supply. So what we see in Milwaukee, in Green Bay, Eau Claire, Wausau, La Crosse, is that we have this really high quality older housing stock. A lot of it was built in the 40s and 50s, and a lot of our multifamily was built in the 60s and 70s. So, and I grew up in one of those older homes in Wausau it's a 1940 style house, and the bones are good in a lot of our housing stock. But what we're seeing across the state is that people just are not able to afford to make the upgrades to bring it up to modern code. And particularly in some of our harder hit areas, if you have to purchase a house, for example, let's say around $90,000 or $100,000 in a lot of areas, right? To bring it up to modern living standards, you may have to put $50,000 into the house.
Mm-hmm.
But that house is not going to appraise or assess for that full value. And so we just don't see that investment. So we talk about in the report, we need new supply to accommodate new demand. But we also, as a state, need to think about how we can provide a kind of affordable and sustainable home rehabilitation program for a lot of our older housing stock. And that's building on the tax base we already have. That creates a lot of high-quality jobs. It can improve the livability and the energy efficiency of a lot of our older housing.
So when our state is not offering the housing options for workers who are needing it, tie this back to our economy. What is the impact to our economy?
So both in the data and the anecdotes that I hear from economic development officials across the state, you know, and I've talked to people in, again, Barron County or Richland Center, small towns, rural areas. They have jobs that they say that they cannot fill. So they have companies that have open jobs, and people, they try to recruit people to come there. They look around, there's no housing, there's no new housing, and so they're just unable to fill those jobs. So we often say that workforce housing is economic development because a house is where a job goes to sleep at night.
Hmm.
But we also talk to a lot of local officials because the neighbors around proposed housing will say, well, we want jobs, but we don't want more housing in our community. And so it's part of that community conversation to say if you want jobs in your community, you ought to be able to take the housing so that the people who work in your community ought to be able to afford to live in your community. I heard a story, for example, the other day where snowplow drivers in the city of Madison cannot afford to live in the city of Madison, so they live an hour away. So when we get those ice storms, our roads are not clear. And we have the same issue in some of our higher-priced areas. Teachers, police officers, firefighters can't afford to live in the community they serve. And that's not right.
You have been talking with lawmakers on the workforce housing shortage issue. What do you want them to know as you testify?
So they ask a lot of great questions because I've testified to the Assembly and the Senate. And again, both parties are working on these issues, and both parties are hearing from their constituents that this is a real crisis and this is a real shortage. So what I'd want them to hear is the overall message that this is a large structural problem. It didn't just magically appear overnight. So there are no easy solutions. It will take us a long time to kind of dig out of this hole. But I do want them to think boldly in terms of what sort of reforms and policies can we adopt that really kind of stimulate housing production and stimulate rehab of existing homes, but also allows us to diversify our housing supply. So it's not just large lot single-family homes and multifamily homes, but a lot of what we talk about in the report of what's called the missing middle. These are the smaller housing units like townhouses or small eight-plex apartment units.
Multi-unit.
Or duplexes even.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that kind of middle housing stock that's not the big apartment complex that people have perceptions of, and it's not the large lot single-family house.
We're talking about a recent study that details the extent of a housing shortage here in Wisconsin. UW-Madison Urban and Regional Planning Professor Kurt Paulson, he's our guide. What is your housing story? Do you rent or own? How have your housing costs changed over the years? How much of your income goes toward rent or your mortgage? And home builders, join in here. Where are you developing? What are you seeing out there? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation on the real estate, on the housing shortage, right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and today is the day. WPR News has a new podcast out. It's called Derailed, Episode 1. It's out. It's in the ether. Derailed is the story of how high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin and the politics behind that. New episodes come out each Wednesday. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org. Right now, we're looking at housing issues in Wisconsin as a new report describes a housing shortage, and this leads to some problems. Housing becomes more expensive. We see a big decline in home ownership and a continued decline in overall housing affordability. So share your stories, your questions, your ideas. 800-642-1234. Are you a baby boomer who is aging in place? Why are you staying in your home? What concerns do you have about the housing market? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Kurt Paulson prepared the report called Falling Behind for the Wisconsin Realtors Association, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Mike is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mike. Hey there, Mike. Are you with us? I'm not sure that Mike is with us, but Mike sold his house 2 years ago for more than the asking price in less than 2 days. And some in the area that do have more housing and the tax base is high. So what do we know there about the turnover of these homes and how quickly they're selling?
Right. So most realtors or real estate economists will tell you that we're looking for kind of a balance between sellers and buyers, which is usually measured in terms of the average time that a house is on the market should be about 6 months. If it's shorter than that, it's a seller's market. And what we're seeing across the state, if you go to the Realtors Association, you can get every month they'll release sales reports for every county. But certainly in a lot of our fast-growing counties and even in our rural counties, we will see that there's 2 or 3 months of supply. Right, and so when there's a tight supply, we see a couple of things happen. As the caller was talking about, if the house is of decent quality, you will get multiple full price plus offers within a short time period. Certainly around here in Madison, if there's nothing wrong with the house, you'll get a good price. So oftentimes the supply that is available might be either in a undesirable location, it's far from jobs or schools, or it might need some rehab or some work.
Some updates.
So this is also where the supply crunch is really being shown in terms of the price. So example, in the report we talk about for the constant quality house, right, adjusting for all these quality changes, house prices are up 18% over 3 years. And again, for individuals, they're falling behind because their income is not keeping up with house prices. So for renters, that means that it's harder to save for a down payment because the rent is high, and then the house that you might want to purchase just keeps getting out of reach.
Just keeps going up. Let's take Gary now in Ripon. Gary, hi.
Hi. Good morning. I don't necessarily disagree with the speaker, and this is not meant to be a comment on immigration, but it's not 1719 anymore, and to me the problem is not that there's a shortage of housing, but that there's too many people.
So what about housing trends? Because we know that we've seen an aging demographic here in Wisconsin. So what can we say about migration into the state?
So the data would show that for the state of Wisconsin, our population is aging. And so that does, as you said, raise the questions of, for many people, aging in place. And not to, again, address the question too much, but because our birth rate is not keeping up with household formation in the state, new people, especially to build the types of housing, because we have a huge, I'll take a step back. We have a huge labor force shortage in Wisconsin, not just in the construction trades and not just in the building trades, but in a lot of industries. And so that's going to have to come through people migrating into the state. And again, if they're unable to see the kind of quality housing construction that they want, we're going to continue to fall behind in terms of our workforce shortage. So I like to always say everybody needs a place to live, a decent, affordable, safe, and healthy home. So regardless of your household size or what your background is, it's really the job of a state to make sure that all of its citizens can have a decent place to live.
And as you say, our state's aging population, older generations, many now want to stay in their home. There's a whole market for aging in place and retrofitting homes that way. How does that affect the housing market?
So I'll make 2 points on that. First of all is, again, a lot of seniors may have owned their home, so they have an asset, but they don't have a lot of income. So, you know, and again, older people in older housing may not want to take on the debt to put in a new furnace or fix the roof. And so they're often living in housing that may not be the most livable for them. You know, accommodations for accessibility or universal design, it's called. It's very difficult for seniors. The other issue is most seniors who want to live age in place are going to need care and assistance. So in any county, you can look at the home health care aides and nursing assistants and all of these people who service older people. And if they can't afford to live in the community where the old people are needing assistance, then you run into this real conundrum. Certainly here in Madison, we talk to people who manage home health care aides. Maybe $12 to $16 an hour, even if you're paying a little bit above market, you might have to live an hour away from the people you're serving.
Clint from Sun Prairie called in, couldn't stay with us. Clint wants to know how access to home financing affects a person's ability to buy. What are the banks doing here?
So to take you back to the time period before the Great Recession, we think that credit was too loose, that too many people were buying houses that maybe they shouldn't have been buying, and that mortgages were being underwritten with much lower underwriting quality standards. So to respond to that crisis, the federal government passed the Dodd-Frank Act and other laws that changed the idea of how we do mortgages to this idea of ability to repay and what's technically called the qualified mortgage rule. So the result of that is that the credit box is much tighter today than it was even in a normal market in the early 2000s. So that means that for a lot of first-time home buyers, even if you had the income to afford your first home, you may not qualify for a mortgage if, for example, you have student loan payments or auto loan payments, because they're going to look at your aggregate debt relative to your income. So if we think that the credit supply, credit box was too loose leading up to the Great Recession, there's a lot of people who think it's too tight now. And I know that we were just at a conference here in Madison with bankers and realtors. There's a lot of banks with a lot of money ready to lend. But on the other hand, there's not that many purchase-ready borrowers because these federal rules are constraining their ability to get mortgage financing. So it's one of these strange situations. If you qualify for a mortgage, interest rates are low and terms are pretty good now. So now would be the ideal time to buy. The problem is a lot of the people who want to buy can't get credit.
Talking with Kurt Paulson, he's an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison, and his research looks at affordable housing policy, municipal finance, land use. Are you trying to buy or continuing to rent? What portion of your income is going to housing? Has that held steady, or is housing becoming more of your budget? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kurt, let's look at zoning laws as well as housing code. What have you learned from your research as you look at zoning and code?
So a lot of people probably don't understand how housing is actually built. So when there is a market demand for new types of housing, whether it be single family or middle housing or multifamily, we would expect that developers and builders would try to acquire land to build the housing that people want. But oftentimes, and we talk about this in the report, that outdated zoning regulations really constrain our housing supply. So the biggest example is in terms of the minimum lot size that is required to build a house. I'll give an example. When I grew up in that 1940s subdivision in Wausau, right, that's a 6,000 square foot house. It's the old FHA type subdivisions, 60 feet wide and 100 feet deep. And if you walked around that neighborhood today, you would say, well, this is a pleasant old neighborhood, right? But in a lot of cities in the state, you could not build that house today because the minimum lot size is not 6,000 square feet. It might be 10, 12, or even 16,000 square feet. Now, just for people's kind of general idea, 10,000 square foot house lot is about a quarter of an acre, right? And one of the ways to bring down housing costs is to allow developers to build smaller houses on smaller lots. It's the old idea of what we would call a starter home, or to build townhouses that would be the kind of move into housing for existing seniors who would then free up a larger single-family home for a family. In many of our communities around the state, you cannot build a multifamily unit by right under the zoning. And so one of the things we talk about in the report is if, as a state, we say we want to allow more housing to be built and a greater variety of housing, then we really, as local governments, have to look at our zoning ordinance, audit our zoning, and see, could a developer actually build the type of housing we want?
We're looking at housing trends around the state with Kurt Paulson. He's an urban and regional planning professor at UW-Madison. And want to hear from you. Have you recently moved to Wisconsin? Did you struggle to find a place to live? What part of the state did you search? What did you find? What concerns do you have about your current housing situation? Are you looking to buy your first home? Maybe you are in the bidding process right now. Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this conversation on housing in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. The Wisconsin Realtors Association says there's a severe workforce housing shortage. We're learning about what that means here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kurt Paulson is in the UW-Madison Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture. He has a new report that looks at the available housing stock in Wisconsin. Let's go to the phones now. Courtney is joining us from Westport. Hi, Courtney.
Hey.
What's your situation like?
Well, I'm living with my parents right now. They bought their home when I was about two. I have two daughters. They're in middle school. And when I moved back to the state, it was really hard for me to find anything in my price point in the school district that I wanted. So moving in with my parents kind of was a temporary thing, but it's turned into kind of a long-term solution. We're retrofitting our home so that my parents can continue to live here. My daughters go to a really great school district. And eventually, you know, it will be my parents and I at home. I'm a nurse. I can take care of them. And, eventually I'll end up owning their home.
Wow.
Probably not a solution for everybody, but it works out all right for us.
Kurt, what do you think about that situation?
So Courtney's situation illustrates, I think, two key points, right? The first is we have people moving into the area who are looking for housing, can't find housing, and so they have to find some flexible way to accommodate. If you don't have a parent that you can move in with, then you maybe have to find a roommate or live far away. The second is that Courtney's case illustrates a really growing trend, which to us looks new, but really is how we used to live 100 years ago, and it's called multi-generational or intergenerational housing. Right? It used to be that you would have in-laws, grandparents, children, even cousins all living together. And now a lot of states and cities are seeing this trend where people want to build a house that has maybe what we would call an accessory unit or a granny flat or even just a separate entrance for the grandparents, that they have their own drive, maybe their own garage and their own entrance. But then, of course, it's all shared on one house structure so that they can take care of each other, take care of the kids. And again, to get back to the zoning issue, zoning that regulates land to be called single family, if you look at any zoning ordinance, it's going to actually define what a family is. And oftentimes, this intergenerational housing, which is again is how we used to do things 100 years ago and is more common in immigrant communities, was oftentimes zoned out so that in many of our cities, if you wanted to add a small apartment or unit on your property for grandma or your mother-in-law that had separate cooking facilities, separate entrances, it would be outlawed in the zoning code. So that's one easy way we can provide more options for people is to allow people to build houses that responds to the family needs that they have. Again, a situation like Courtney's where you'd maybe want three generations living together. They can share living expenses. They can take care of one another.
Mm, wow. Let's go to Dave now in Green Bay. Dave, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So I understand you're a municipal planner.
I am. I'm a municipal planner, and I work extensively with zoning codes. And I just wanted to make a comment. Our zoning code in the community I work for has a very small lot size minimum. And we as municipal planners are encouraging small lots to be developed and also infill lots, old smaller lots, to be developed as well. The issue that we're finding is that the development community doesn't see enough return on investment to actually develop lots of those size. So though our code allows a lot to be, let's say, 7,000 square feet, on average, our new lots are anywhere between 12,000 and 15,000 square feet. And it's not actually the encouragement of the city is to make smaller lots, but it's the development community that is not embracing that. And that might be, I don't think it's specific to our market, but it's definitely, if you're not in a heavy urban area, it's very indicative of what smaller communities are seeing. That it's not the zoning code per se, though they do have issues. It's more the development community. Dave, I was just wondering if
Dave, thanks for bringing that. What do you make of that, Kurt?
So, what Dave's talking about brings a number of issues to the fore, right? So, in our southeast and in the Dane County area, that would not be true. That if you build a small lot, that there's plenty of developers who want to build on that, even though that product is still going to look much more expensive to us than even a large lot in Green Bay or Rhinelander. So outside of those kind of high-growth urban corridors in the south, I mean in the southern part of the state, Dave is absolutely right. And I like when cities say that we encourage smaller lots and they allow it. Of course, there's nothing that would require a developer to build the minimum lot. And what it illustrates is that to cover their land costs, they often do have to go for a higher-end luxury product with a higher finish level and a larger home. So what I'm seeing around the state is when if you do want those smaller lots that produce smaller houses, even with construction costs, right? Again, it might be in Green Bay, for example, $260,000 to $300,000, depending on the finish level. There's there's actually not that much demand for that type of housing at that price point in those smaller lots. So what cities can do is they can not only build smaller lots, but allow developers to perhaps cluster some of the homes together in what we might call a pocket neighborhood or, you know, kind of townhouses, and then leave the rest as open space. But this may be a case where cities, if they want that housing stock, do have to provide some financial incentives through TIF or through loans to help build that housing. Because in Green Bay, for example, right, we don't have a lot of that entry-level housing that's of decent quality that would be affordable to someone making $35,000 to $40,000 a year, for example.
Let's bring in Paul now in Heartland. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just like to comment on what your guest was saying earlier about the multi-generational housing. My grandma and I bought a duplex together 2 years ago in Heartland, and it's really worked out really well. It saved us both a lot of money. It's allowed me to kind of look after her, you know, and I think it's going to probably keep her, you know, independent for longer. And she's got to enjoy, you know, my son, her grandbaby, right next door. We eat, we share meals together often. It's just a really great way to kind of stay close and, you know, have our relatives close by.
Oh, Paul, what a great story there. Did you find it difficult to find that duplex, or was it a pretty straightforward thing?
Oh, it's actually really funny you say that. Well, the first night we went looking for houses, we found just the perfect place. But it's a side-by-side, and one of the units is just a little bit smaller. So it's perfect for her, and then the other unit is a practical, like, three-bedroom, and it's like a shared backyard. So we almost didn't buy the place because we only went looking one night.
For one night. Oh, Paul.
One night, but we found just a perfect place. So 2 years later, we still think it's perfect. So.
Paul, thanks so much. Kurt, you never know.
And that's a great story. And I'd be willing to bet, if Paul's still on the line, that duplex was probably built in the 70s or 80s.
Mm. 71.
71?
Yep.
Yeah. The truth is, we haven't built duplexes in any volume in this state for 30 years. And that's also, again, largely driven by zoning code. So Paul's a perfect example. We want to provide flexible options for families that is something other than the kind of large lot single family or just the multifamily. Of course, we need to build all housing types, but that kind of diverse, flexible housing stock is really in short supply.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but let's bring this full circle. Is our current housing market prepared for another recession if it would come?
Well, the problem with another recession is we're going to keep adding people, and everyone needs a place to live. But if we do face a recession, you can expect housing production to go even lower, which would make our long-term problem even worse.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kurt Paulson is an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. He recently wrote the study, Falling Behind Addressing Wisconsin's Workforce Housing Shortage. Just ahead, we find out what happened when high-achieving women left the workforce a dozen years ago due to family reasons and the process of trying to return to work. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.